I'm in a position to know, because the Patrick Henry Society has studied the whole thing. The real problem, whether you like it or not, is whether you're going to sit back and let desegregation spread throughout the entire South. And it's an indisputable fact that there could be no other result. The Negroes will literally, and I do mean literally, control the South. The vote will be theirs. You'll have black mayors and black policemen the way they do in Chicago and New York already. Like is not a black governor and black doctors to deliver your babies. If they find time, that is. And that's the way it'll be. Did you ever stop to think about that? When you let those 10 enter your school, did you?
Good afternoon, boys and girls. Guess what it is? It's September. It's still September the 29th, 2017, and it's Freya's Day, Ladies' Day in the bunker. Well, I got great news for you, whether you believe it or not. Separatism is growing worldwide in massive numbers, and it's happening fast. Everywhere you look in the news, there's separatist organizations and going. That is good news for us. We are winning, because once you get the separatism breaking down these big capitalista units called nations back towards a more tribal situation, then they will gravitate towards their own and race will come to the fore. Got it? So anybody says we're losing, they're full of shit. The latest news is all covered with it. Separatism everywhere. You've even got a separatism here in California. Northern, Southern California want to split up. So you got to support that. Anytime anybody wants separation or splitting up, support it, no matter who it is. Yeah, there you go. Eat your heart out, divisionists. We're the real divisionists. You're just faking it, because there's so many people that are too stupid to understand the difference. Thursday night is old folks at the theater. Cheap tickets. And so last night, me and my main squeeze, we went to a movie with Tom Cruise, which I didn't have too much hopes for, but it turned out a lot better than I thought. Yeah, American Made is the title, and it's all about the Contra thing in Nicaragua and all the drugs that were flown into Mena, Arkansas by the CIA and then transported up to L.A. to mostly sell in the black neighborhoods. Yeah, well, anyhow, it's a little bit like something out of my past. Barry Seal was the guy that was involved, and of course this is a highly Hollywoodized version of what happened, but it's all about them flying guns into the Contras who weren't worth a shit, and how the Nicaraguans military were outsmarting them, and then how they were flying load after load after drugs into Mena, Arkansas, and that's where our guy, or actually an Aryan Nations man by the name of Snell, had been hanging on the chain link fence, taking pictures and putting down what he saw. And he saw all these CIA planes coming in there, unloading. Subsequently, he was set up, and I don't know how it happened, but he got in a shootout with a deputy sheriff, I believe it was. And he did go in and take out a pawnbroker who he thought was Jewish, but there may have been something much more to it, or the whole thing could have been a setup. So he sat in prison for a long time, but the night the Murrah building came down in Oklahoma City was the night that they executed Snell. Sounds a little interesting, doesn't it? So it was sort of part of, a little bit off to the side, but still part of this movie. and it's fantasized, of course, but you ought to go see it because that all that stuff was happening, and it shows Reagan and how phony, and Ollie North, what a crook and what a warmonger he was, and how they were all lying, every one of them lying every time. So that's American Made. Go see it. I'm not a big Tom Cruise fan, but he did a pretty good job in this. That was during the time when I supported Aryan Nations and knew about Aryan Nations, and Dick Butler was a good friend of mine. But I wasn't privy and didn't want to be privy to their operations, so there's probably some people out there that could fill me in a little more. But that's a little bit. I think I heard this right, that 75% of professional football and basketball is black. Well, I didn't know it was that high, but it probably is. I haven't read these positions that war has taken over the years, but I'm going to do it today. Redo it. The position we have on race. The great white Aryan race must be advanced and protected at all cost and above all other issues. Your family is or should be your most prized treasure, as should your extended white family of racial conscious white men and women. War associates are individuals, not robots. As individuals, we may disagree on many issues, but on the race, we must stand together. The environment. A healthy white race cannot remain healthy in a polluted environment. Overpopulation by non-white invaders destroys the racial and natural environment. Any method that reverses this deterioration is good. We are well aware of corporate greed and its effect on our delicate environment. It's up to all of us to clean up and shape up. Also, massive consumerism stimulates overproduction. Overproduction leads to big-time waste. Conservative lifestyles of quality, used clothes, furniture, and appliances assist in a small way of cutting down on waste. Buying used is not demeaning, and refurbishing pre-used items helps cut back on waste. Madison Avenue propaganda, designed to tempt you into buying what you may not need, is not a beneficial thing for our environment. Conservation and common sense are the watchwords. Armed conflict. Aryans should not support foreign military conflicts for the enrichment of transnational corporations. Aryan nations should never war against non-white nations, except for living space or food. Aryan nations should control their population so as to live peacefully within their well-defined borders. For example, an Aryan North America would respect the borders of Mexico and carry on trade. The primary need for armed conflict is to protect the gene pool. Modern wars of this century have been primarily trade wars, spurred on by capitalist overproduction, seeking new markets for products. These wars were not for the benefit of the white people, since millions of white people died in World War I and World War II alone, both military and civilian. The finest specimen of our race have died in wars which had nothing to do with cultural and racial well-being and advancement. One of America's most decorated Marine Corps generals, Smedley Butler, said, "War is a racket," in his book by the same name. Abortion. War supports birth control and abortion for non-whites living in North America. War encourages racially conscious white women to produce white children. War does not promote force against white women to bear unwanted children. As the non-white races continue to breed with little control, white people have voluntarily destroyed millions of healthy white babies. Future doctors, scientists, and engineers who will never serve their race. Those who have brought into Those who have bought into a suicidal way of thinking must at some point receive future Aryan justice. Right and left wing, the controlled arms on the same Frankenstein body. War is strictly racist. A house or a race divided cannot prosper. Healthy ideas of both left and right, along with totally new ideas, must form a growing united front. An ally is an individual group who makes a positive contribution towards racial separation. This includes blacks, Asians, and others who honestly support a program of racial separation. An enemy is one who is opposed to us, those who promote race mixing, which leads to hybridization, whether consciously or unconsciously, contribute to our racial destruction. No matter what their motives, these people are the enemy, no matter what their race, nationality, or religion. Religion. Our race is our religion. War condemns priestcraft and all religions. War will not allow religious theories and unproven myths to interfere with Aryan survival and advancement. Whites must deal with reality and the world around them. We must demand evidence by those who attempt to control us through unsubstantiated stories from the Middle East. International. War advises all U.S. racial activists to concentrate on freeing North America from non-white aliens and from racial suicide. Currently, we are in the midst of negrophilia. Aryans of Europe must develop their own Aryan movements. White Europeans have unique problems that need to be addressed by their own leaders. War must concentrate on North America. We do not recognize a border between white nations. North American Aryans must concentrate their efforts where they will count. We cannot be carpetbaggers to the world. Our war is North America. If we cannot save North America for the Aryan future, it is unlikely that Europe will survive either. North American Aryans are facing the ultimate challenge that will be irreversible at some future point. War salutes all Aryans struggling around the world. However, the motto, "Charity Begins at Home," must be the watchword. Rights. War promotes possibilities built on the strong. War does not support the myth of God-given or natural rights. War deals with evidence and not faith. War promotes a natural aristocracy. Rights is a terrible misused word which caused more bloodshed and sorrow than most other words. It is an abstract term which should be replaced with the word privilege. All systems grant privileges as long as you are a dutiful citizen and follow orders. Those who act as individuals and act on that premise may quickly find their privileges taken away. There is very little, if anything, that the strong cannot take from the weak. White people must always depend upon their intelligence and the use of their muscle to back it up instead of this belief in abstract rights. Economics. Economics is important to the welfare of the Aryan people. When economics threatens our existence, then those policies must be radically changed. The present Coca-Cola society is a direct threat to the race, and the stability of world economic determinism must be secondary to racial determinism. The superstate. The rise of the superstate based on economics is a direct threat to racial integrity. The state must be viewed as an enemy who is destroying our culture for power and profit. But that's beginning to come unraveled now, as you can see all over the world. People are getting sick of it. War recognizes the basic differences between male and female. Beyond that, war encourages women to involve themselves to the limit of their abilities to further the interests of the race. Qualified women operate at all levels of war. Most attitudes towards women are handed down from the major religions of Muslim, Judaism, and Judeo-Christianity, These belief structures are anti-Aryan. The Judaized concept of women is the most obscene. The Aryan male and female are a team. Homosexuals. The desire to propagate one's kind is natural. It is rare in nature that this drive is limited. The question is, does nature call out those it finds unfit for reproduction? Homosexuals must be encouraged to separate their lifestyles from the community at large. Homosexuality must not be taught as a positive lifestyle. The homosexual population is quite small and not the major threat to Aryan survival. The right wing is obsessed with this subject and devotes too much time and money on this segment of the population. Closet homosexuals have existed for thousands of years. The best an Aryan heterosexual society can do is to limit their collective influence and keep the closet door shut. This issue must be approached from a genetic view. Preferred form of government, Aryan oligarchy based on genetic aristocracy. That's the end of our war positions that we've held for decades and decades, so we hope you like it. Now here is a guest editorial from In War from August of 2000. Holocaust, who's got the Holocaust? The following was not created by war, but an English writer talking about a new book destined to cause an uproar among Jewish elitists. A Jewish academic is afraid that rampant exploitation of the Holocaust is summoning up a new anti-Semitism. It is hard not to agree, says Brian Appleyard. Well, you see, boys and girls, how that's come true? All this left-wing anti-Semitism now? This guy was right on. It's hard not to agree, said Brian Appleyard. Stop in the name of a Holocaust. I sometimes think, writes an American academic, Dr. Norman Finkelstein, the worst thing that ever happened to the Nazi Holocaust was that American Jewry discovered it. This quotation comes from the Finkelstein's explosive and bitterly angry book, The Holocaust Industry, to be published this month. It accuses those who exploit the Holocaust of telling lies, conniving in Israel atrocities, and naked greed. The pursuit of reparations from Swiss bankers and others is damned as an outright extortion racket. The ruthless industrialization of the Holocaust has encouraged the rebirth of anti-Semitism in Europe and the United States. Well, I got up disturbed there. Let me see if I can get back on track. Yeah. Well, I'll start here, but I've probably read that before. This quotation comes from the Finkelstein's explosive and bitterly angry book, The Holocaust Industry, to be published this month. It accuses those who exploit the Holocaust of telling lies, conniving in Israeli atrocities, and of naked greed. The pursuit of reparations from Swiss bankers and others is damned as an outright extortion racket. The ruthless industrialization of the Holocaust has encouraged the rebirth of anti-Semitism in Europe and the United States, especially in the left. And in conversation with me, he said that the fascination with Holocaust memorials and museums, the latest being the permanent exhibition at London's Imperial War Museum, opened by the Queen last week, was a kind of a circus. If any of this had been written or said by a non-Jew with no direct experience of the Holocaust, it would have been savaged as anti-Semitism, or worse, Holocaust denial. But Finkelstein is a Jew, though non-observant, both of whose parents were survivors of the Warsaw Ghetto and the concentration camps. All members of their families were wiped out by the Nazis. Even so, his views make him an outcast among the American Jewish establishment, and define him for many as the enemy of Israel. So why has he done it? I will not have, he shouts down from the phone from New York, the suffering of my parents used for any ulterior purposes, whether it be prevention of assimilation of Jews or the defense of Israel. Finkelstein's father never spoke of his experience, but his mother spoke of little else. Yet he recalls even she was disgusted at the rise of the Holocaust industry in America. There were, he says, only 60,000 Jewish survivors of the camps, and 20,000 of those died in the first week after liberation. Yet in the 1960s and 70s, many of his parents' friends started claiming to be survivors. Soon everybody was a victim of the great martyrdom. Quote, I'm not exaggerating when I say that one out of three Jews you stop in this street in New York City will claim to be a survivor. And since 1993, the industry has been claiming that 10,000 survivors have been dying every month. That is completely impossible. It would mean that there were 8 million survivors in 1945, but there were only 7 million Jews in German-occupied Europe before the war. Finkelstein says the Holocaust industry was born at a time of the Six-Day War in June 67. Before that, both the Holocaust and Israel were scarcely mentioned in American public life, but it was not born, as many have said, out of fear of the survival of Israel. Rather, it sprang from American strategic interests. Israel became the American surrogate in the Middle East, and the Holocaust was evoked morally to justify the alliance, and it sold well with the Christian fundamentalists. Israel became the defender of U.S. values, and since America at the time was losing the Vietnam War, it was a more effective defender than America herself. The American Jewish elite embraced the cause of Israel and created the contemporary image of the Holocaust. Finkelstein highlights the power of this elite by pointing out that Jewish income is almost double that of non-Jews. 16 of the 40 wealthiest Americans are Jews. 40% of the Nobel Prize winners in science and economics are Jewish. 20% of the professors at main universities are Jewish. And then you wonder why the students are going to hell in these universities? As are 40% of the partners in law firms in New York City and Washington. Led by campaigners such as Simon Wiesenthal and Eli Wiesel, Finkelstein claims the latter gets a minimum lecture fee of $25,000 plus chauffeured limousine. The industry insists on the unique nature of the atrocity. It can be compared, they say, to nothing else. Finkelstein rightly, I believe, identifies this as the intellectual heart of the matter. Yeah, the other problems like this, atrocities took place. How about the Armenian genocide? Wiesel and others insist that the Holocaust stands outside history and rational discussion. The only final response is silent incomprehension. This position has become so extreme that any attempt to compare it with other episodes of human cruelty. Finkelstein mentions the deaths of 10 million Africans in the Congo as a result of the Belgian ivory and rubber trade, is often met with accusations of anti-Semitism and Holocaust denial. The result is that America is dotted with Holocaust museums and memorials, but there is none for the many other more victims of communism. There's not even one for the gypsies and the mentally and physically disabled who died under Nazism. Finkelstein says that a higher proportion of the gypsy population of Europe died than of the Jewish. And at this most scathing, Finkelstein points out that there is no memorials to the millions who died in the slave trade or in the genocidal campaign against the American Indians. The presence of the Holocaust Museum in Washington is particularly incongruous to the absence of a museum commemorating crimes in the course of American history. My parents would never have claimed that the Holocaust was unique, he says. They would have said it made them sympathetic to the suffering of other oppressed people. The danger of uniqueness argument is that it blinds us to the possibility of other forms of evil. People see the Holocaust museums and memorials. They see the face of Hitler and they think that this is what evil is like. The truth is that evil also wore the mask of Stalin, Lenin, Mao, Pol Pot, and if we are convinced that evil must wear jackboots and a little mustache, we may not recognize in the next time round. Finkelstein adds that the leaders of the Holocaust industry used the uniqueness arguments to convince themselves of their own virtue. If this particular suffering and martyrdom were worse than that for other victims, including indirect victims such as contemporary Jews and the whole state of Israel, then who dares say a word against the moral stature of those who daily remind us? So is he right? Well, in one key sense, he must be. The Holocaust cannot be unique. Every starved, tortured, and murdered person of any race has something in common with the victims of Auschwitz. The idea that one historical event is different from all others is plainly irrational. It is also dangerous because it silences discussion and analysis of the Holocaust. And when that happened, we lose our ability to learn anything. The challenge today, writes Finkelstein, is to restore the Nazi Holocaust as a rational subject of inquiry. The abnormality of the Nazi Holocaust springs not from the event itself, but from the exploitive industry that has grown up around it. The noblest gestures for those who perished is to preserve their memory, learn from their sufferings, and let them finally rest in peace. However, is Finkelstein correct that the Holocaust industry is entirely self-serving, corrupt, and destructive? It is true that it has produced absurd fantasies like Benjamin Wilkomirski, who have persuaded publishers and scholars of the truth of their fabricated tales of survival under the Nazis. Many of the claims of those who pursue reparations are plainly outrageous, and I do not doubt that the political ruthlessness with which many of these claims have been enforced upon us, as Finkelstein says, are encouraging a new wave of anti-Semitism, which we can actually see now with coming from the left more than the right. His attack on the Holocaust industry would well have reached far-reaching effects, and acceptance of his broad case would ultimately weaken the American support for Israel, as it would undermine the sympathy created by the idea of the unique suffering of the Jews. It might also be removed from the cultural adhesive of the Holocaust experience, accelerate the process of assimilation of Jews into mainstream, the dilution of Jewish identity primarily by marrying out, which has already resulted in the loss of millions in the diaspora, Jews in the United States and elsewhere. For other groups, resisting assimilation or mixing is classed as racist, but not so with the Jew. Finkelstein is not too concerned about either of these outcomes. He would like the Israeli case to be more rationally considered, and though he acknowledges the ethnic loss involved in assimilation mixing, he prefers the Martin Luther King position that people would mix together irrespective of the color of their skin, their race or beliefs. You see, there's a lot of stuff in here I don't agree with, and I'm sure you don't agree with. If the Holocaust has become a brand name, which I agree it has, then that is a big problem. But there are some babies you really don't throw out with the bathwater, and the ethnocentrism of Jewishness is one of them. The Holocaust industry, reflections of the exploitation of Jewish suffering by Norman G. Finkelstein, is published by Verso, V-E-R-S-O, on July 20th, 2000. There you go. There's a lot of stuff in there I don't agree with, but I think it's good that a Jew has come out and exposed so much of this. What we should know, it's an impossibility for it to have happened like they claim. It's impossible. I mean, you could say a lot of Jews died, a lot of pit killings and so forth, but you can't use these pieces of evidence to get the story straight. It's impossible. It's impossible. It's impossible. The Zionist Jews will not tolerate somebody just saying, hey, a lot of Jews died, and that's too bad, but it happened. But not 6 million. You can't get away with that. Then you're a Nazi if you don't. Even brand Jews as Nazis for saying things like that. It can be said also that there were lots and lots of Jews that were Nazis, definitely. And I think probably some of them were in the high command, according to the book I've got on that subject. Brings me around to the statement that I think they should have gotten rid of all the bad Jews in Germany. There were plenty of them. And the rich and the bankers and all those kind of people, and got them out of there and let them go to Israel. They didn't need a mass extermination of a cross section of German Jews. Didn't need it. In the end, it was totally counterproductive. Well, I think a couple of days ago I read to you The Christian Plague, Part 1 by Keith Butcher, who's a very good writer and a federal prisoner, or at least he was the last time I talked to him. So let me read to you part 2 of The Christian Plague. Christianity claimed literally thousands and thousands of lives. More than 100,000 suspected witches were killed in Germany, over 30,000 in France. It has been recorded that close to 9 million executions of pagans, most being women, took place between the years of 1484 and 1782 during the witch hysteria. Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live, says Exodus 22:18, and in Deuteronomy 18:10-12, there shall not be found among you anyone that maketh his son or his daughter to pass through fire, or that useth divination, or an observer of times, or an enchanter, or a witch. Wording in all biblical quotes may vary depending on the translation that you have. There are some 300,000 variations in the New Testament alone. Both 5,000 in the Greek manuscripts and the King James has been translated over 500 times. Subsequently, the legacy of the death cult under these types of pious biblical scribes justified their slaughter of Aryan women. There were some gallant and courageous sisters during the Dark Ages who, despite the threat of persecution, kept their pagan faith alive and organized witchery into a formal cult opposed by the Roman Catholic Church. They would often meet secretly at night dressed in stark black, hence the origins and traditions of wearing black to mock an approaching Christian holiday. They especially enjoyed the mocking of All Saints' Day, November 1st, where they could meet on the day prior. This day, October 31st, became well known locally as the Night of the Witch, and later as All Hallows' Eve, and today is celebrated as Halloween. If one reads the story of Adam and Eve as told in the Bible scriptures, it should be clear to even the most casual observer that this story is a blatant attack on women and goddess worship. It is an attempt to additionally undermine the polytheistic, life-loving nature religions of our ancestors, to be replaced by a monotheistic, life-hating religion devoid of female elements. In many pre-Christian religions, such as Zoroastrianism, Druidism, or Odinism, the god pantheon was made up by both male and female. The female goddesses were often depicted with snakes, flowers and fruits or fruit trees. For example, the Greek god goddess Demeter, who is always shown holding snakes along with wheat and or grains, and Venus, who is shown nude with flowers and or fruits, and Iduna, the Norse goddess who produced the life-juvenating apples, is always shown nude under an apple tree, surrounded by cats. Iduna and her apples are symbolic. Her nude breast symbolizes the nourishment, and her apples are the symbolic of the nature of women. She denotes the immortality of the race and eternal youth. Our pagan ancestors clearly understood the need for both male and female gods in order to make a complete circle of life. They fashioned their religions based upon the polytheistic natural themes: gods of the sky, the earth, or fertility, and of the unknown, as well as those attributed to ancestors and heroes of the folk or the race. In the story of Adam and Eve, we have all the traditional goddess symbology: the nude woman, the magical special tree, and the snake, all in the center of a lush garden. In the ancient Mesopotamian stories, the man is simply kicked out of the garden. However, with the new Christianization version, we have a perversion of the original story. The woman Eve is demeaned and made out to be evil. She gives into temptation and is seduced by the evil serpent. Then she turns around and bribes Adam, the man, into taking part in a so-called sin. Afterwards, when the head honcho Yahweh finds out and thus asks Adam what went down, Adam blames it on Eve instead of standing up and defending her like any honorable man would do. What happened as a result of this perversion? All the people of the earth must now pay the price for this original sin. It's all Eve's fault. Other anti-woman texts in the Bible, out of the hundreds, are when a woman has her monthly menstrual period. She is considered, according to the Bible, unclean and must be isolated from all others. And if by chance someone happens to touch her during this period, he or she too is considered unclean. And when a woman who gives birth to a child, she is also condemned and is considered unclean. If she gives birth to a male child, she must be isolated like some sort of diseased animal for a total of 40 days and 80 days for a female child. The Bible demeans and degrades women into being mere objects of pure evil and sin, and claims they should be ashamed of themselves and their bodily functions rather than accepting them as being purely a natural thing. And we can't leave out Numbers 5:11-31, where women are to be put through a sadistic and humiliating bizarre practice of bitter testing to see if they have committed adultery. And if they happen to fail in this bold test, where they are forced to drink a foreign substance, her belly is to swell and her thighs rot. Some translations say genital organs to shrink. And how about Deuteronomy 25:12? Thou shalt cut off the hand of any woman who grabs the private parts of a man. Perverted and all out weird. Yes, all by it. If one has ever read the Jewish Talmud, you will see these same type perverted practices and laws. It doesn't surprise one much when it is realized that they have the same Jewish origins. Friedrich Nietzsche, 1844-1900, quote, as the worst counterfeits in existence invented to debase nature and all natural values, the priest himself is seen as he actually is, as the most dangerous form of parasite, as the venomous spider of creation, unquote. Bible authors plagiarist. The various stories that make up the Christian Bible, both Old and New Testaments, were ripped off from other cultures and religions. I will give a few examples, albeit by no means the entire analysis. For starters, the story of Noah and the flood was obviously taken from earlier myths, in particular those of the Mesopotamian origin. The Mesopotamian empires rose about 8,000 BC. The Sumerian epic of Gilgamesh, which recounts the story of a flood, a surviving family, and a ship which rests on the edge of a mountain top, has detailed the parallels with that of the Noah story. The tablets recounting this epic and other Mesopotamian stories were discovered between 1849 and 1854 while British archaeologists were excavating a site at Nineveh, a buried city. In all, 25,000 clay tablets were unearthed at this site dating to the 7th century BC. And to go back even further, we can trace the Gilgamesh epic to the ancient Sumerian epic of the Deluge, which dates to ca. 2000 BC. The story of creation as told in Genesis can easily retrace to not one but two Mesopotamian stories. The Assyrian Enuma Elish was a story where the supreme deity, Asher is called Marduk in the Babylonian version of Assyria, fought and killed the mother goddess Tiamat, and then mutilated her body in a ritualistic steps using pieces to create the universe, the earth, and its life forms or inhabitants, the six steps paralleling with the Bible 6 days. It took to create the world. An even older story dating to ca. 3000 BC is where the Sumerian gods create a divine garden for themselves and place a lesser god in charge of it. Ironically, in this story, this lesser god is told not to eat of the certain plant within the garden, and he is later expelled from the garden and is made into a mortal after his banishment. He's given 8 assistants who all have special capabilities. The parallels here are obvious. As in Genesis, Cain is banished and had 8 descendants, all of whom had special crafts or trades. Ironically, in this story, the lesser god is told not to eat of a certain plant. I read that. After his banishment, he is given 8 assistants who all have special capabilities. The parallels here are obvious. As in Genesis, Cain is banished and had 8 descendants, all of whom had special crafts or trades. The Bible story of the birth of Moses can be traced to the Egyptian story of the birth of Sargon, dating to 2371 BC. Where Sargon's mother, to save her child, hides Sargon in a woven basket and sends him off into a river. Sargon is later found by a farmer and is raised by him. Sargon grows up and then becomes a king. You see where all this Jewish crap is borrowed from, stolen from other people? They steal everything. Nail everything down or they'll steal it. The story of Jesus' death and subsequent resurrection, as well as the alleged ascension of Mary to heaven, was copied from the ancient Greek story of Hercules, where he and his mother were taken to Mount Olympus. Several biblical stories or proverbs, Matthew, Romans, and Exodus, can be traced to the Egyptian Book of the Dead, which dates to 1580 BC. With portions of said book dating even to 2600 BC. Other stories in Deuteronomy, Ezekiel, and the book of Daniel, and Isaac, Abraham, Sarah, Jacob, all these can be traced back to the 14th century BC, where they are told in the Canaanite Bible. The tablets of these writings can be found in North Canaan, Syria, in 1929 by archaeologists. And that's the end of the reading for this today on that. Thank you, Keith Butcher. Wherever you're at, boy, I hope you're okay. I hope you got paroled. Well, that's the end of today's show. I'm cutting it a little close because I'm a little tired today. And so we'll be back here on Moon's Day and have a good weekend. I'm going out to a comedy act at a local historical old theater here in town. And if it's too Jewish and dirty, I'm going to walk out. Don't forget, we're winning. We're winning. Separation's going on all over the world. People are fighting to be separate. Support all separatist practices. Yeah.